Hi, friends. Welcome to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today, we're joined by author Jason Berry, who is an investigative reporter. He's based in New Orleans. He's also a film director. He attended Jesuit High School in New Orleans, graduated in 1967. Then he went to Georgetown University. He has since compiled an amazing record of work with a number of books. Up from the Cradle of Jazz, Lead Us Not Into Temptation, about Catholic priests and abuse, The Spirit of Black Hawk, The Last of the Red Hot Papas, and his most recent book that we're really here to talk about is A City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300. Is there something... Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you, Pearson. Great to be with you.
I know you've been around Acadiana for a while, off and on over the years, so welcome back.
It's a pleasure.
Is there something that binds your entire oeuvre together in particular?
Yes. I would say there have been two overarching stories in my life that I pursued as a writer. The city of my birth and the church in which I was raised. And I've done that in some rather wide-ranging books and articles and film work, as you noted. I suppose I've been on a spiritual journey, and I keep searching.
Well, that's the important thing, right? Because if you found the answers, there would be no point in talking, you know, other than you could just tell us and then we could go, oh, well, that's it.
I'm afraid I would have stayed home, yes.
I just finished your most recent book, City of a Million Dreams, and I found it to be jam full of interesting and peculiar characters. And I was taken in with a number of them, and so I'd like to talk about some of those, and in so doing, maybe we can talk about some of the history of New Orleans that you talk about. Let's start talking about Leafy Anderson and Mother Catherine Seals, two people that I knew absolutely nothing about. What's the connection between these visionaries, the people they served, the visions they had, and the jazz that seemed to run through what they did?
The subtitle of the book is A History of New Orleans at Year 300, and I wanted to, in this book, which appeared at the end of the tricentennial year, orchestrate a cast of characters across the stage of history. And in doing so, I was following a theme, the way in which a culture of spectacle kept pushing against a city of laws, the culture of spectacle rooted in the African-American slave dances at Congo Square, and the city of laws, officialdom, the official city that for so long was anchored in white supremacy. So the book is really about culture pushing against the law. Leafy Anderson is one of the more fascinating people I have written about and wish I had the good fortune of meeting. She died in 1927 after establishing the spiritual church movement in New Orleans. These are small houses of worship, primarily African American, but there were some, particularly Sicilian women, who were involved in the early years. And it was a belief in the invocation of benevolent spirits to assist the living as they moved about their lives. She held concerts on the roof of her, on the rooftop balcony of her home. Invited jazz musicians, had jazz musicians who played in her small vernacular church at a time when the mainstream Black Baptist and Protestant AME churches would never hear of having a drummer and a trumpeter play. So she sort of took that scriptural line, make a joyful noise, and expanded upon it. One of the women she trained, Mother Catherine Seals, moved to the Lower Ninth Ward in 1922 and established a huge compound with a large tent where musicians played. She herself was a trombonist. But more than that, Mother Catherine was a galvanizing speaker. She took in pregnant girls, battered women, and was a created a kind of spiritual harbor for people going through very difficult times. And I had the good fortune of getting to know a woman named Ann Cagnoletti, whose parents had met at this place known as the Manger and married many years before. So I had a family history that she made available to me. And the stories of how she healed people are legion. And there were many oral histories done in the 1930s by the Federal Works Project, the WPA Writers Project. And they spoke of her miraculous powers of healing. Well, I took these various accounts of healing, and I found a colleague in Canada, Jacqueline Duffy, who has written two books on miracle cures at the Vatican, how the Vatican assesses stories of miraculous cures. And everything I provided her about Mother Catherine's healing powers seemed to check out. Taking a live chicken, cutting it open, putting it over a broken limb to compress the swelling down. These were stories that animated me, and I was thrilled to learn that a medical authority, she's both a physician and a historian, agreed that they were valid. So I was taken in by both of these women in the course of the writing.
Amazing. Now, did Leafy Anderson play or perform herself?
She was pretty good with the tambourine, as was Mother Catherine. Many of the spiritual church leaders had some musical facility or another. But I think what made her most famous is that she invoked the spirit of Black Hawk the Indian.
That's an interesting connection.
Indeed it is. He was a legendary figure from the upper Midwest. The 1832 Black Hawk War in Illinois is named for him. He visited the White House. In fact, Jefferson Davis, as a young officer, escorted him to meet President Andrew Jackson. And the whole point of this, taking him out of prison to meet the president, was to persuade him that the country was changing. There is this westward expansion. In essence, they were saying, please get with the program and don't make war. He went back. His final years in Wisconsin were fairly peaceful. He dictated a memoir near the end of his life. And his spirit is now invoked in these small churches as a kind of protector or guardian angel.
This makes me want to go back and read one of the of your other books, The Spirit of Black Hawk, right?
Indeed. I did that book in 1995. It was a way of recovering from the Lead Us Not Into Temptation, which I published in 92, the first third of which is, of course, based on the reporting I did here in Lafayette in the early 85, 86. Yeah, The Spirit of Black Hawk is a deeper, more textured portrait of Leafy Anderson. By the time I began work on the New Orleans history and was moving toward my deadline to get it out last fall for the tricentennial, I was much more taken with the way in which Mother Catherine basically parted ways with her mentor, Leafy Anderson. And I don't think it was just Black Hawk that caused the rupture, if you will. Leafy was a Christian. Catherine was nominally, but she was much more a person who created a movement around herself, a sort of great mother, you might say, out of Greco-Roman pre-Christian history.
And did she continue? I know that Leafy Anderson's followers weren't supposed to call on the name of Jesus because I guess Jesus was too specific. Did she continue that tradition?
Well, I think what you find with all of these spiritual churches is a certain fluidity and people who embraced Christianity in their own ways. For example, Mother Catherine, although she never really talked a lot about Christ, was nevertheless grounded in the idea of women as a source of Christian witness. The drummer in her tent, Deacon Frank Lastie, was a young man who had been with Louis Armstrong in the Colored Waifs Home, which was basically a reform school. And Frank Lasty, I first interviewed back in the 70s, and he told me how he was transformed and converted by Mother Catherine. Well, he went on to lead a church in the Lower Ninth Ward where his three sons all got their start playing music, and the third generation of drummers following in the grandfather's footsteps, you might say, we now find in Herlin Riley, who is a distinguished drummer, played for years with Wynton Marsalis, has his own recordings, and Joseph Lasty Jr., who for years played with the Preservation Hall Band.
This is interesting. Now, it should be noted that both, I think, Leafy Anderson and maybe Sister Mother Catherine had jazz bands, like big jazz bands, 10-piece jazz bands that played. So the music at that point and the culture and the things, the spiritualism that's going on seems to be all swirling around together at that time. What's kind of the ferment there, and what's the role of jazz music in all of that at that moment?
I really appreciate that question very, very much, because if I may say, I think my treatment of the birth of jazz in this book goes well beyond what the standard jazz histories say at this point, and I do it in a very different way, with great respect to people like Ted Gioia, Thomas Brothers, Bruce Rayburn, and others. I take it back to the 1880s, which was the time of the lost cause. You know, the Civil War had ended. Reconstruction really was the war after the war. Statues to the Confederacy were going up across the region. Blacks, after a brief time in Louisiana with the right to vote, were then purged from the rolls, and lynching became the tool of resurgent white supremacy. This is when jazz music starts to emerge, as 40,000 rural black folk starting, well, between 1880 and 2000, move into New Orleans and carry with them traditions of jubilee dancing, ecstatic spirit worship in these small churches in the plantation belt. They arrive in a city filled with pianos and horns and brass bands, in which African-American men are now taking on a more and more prominent role. So historically, the European brass bands played melodies to ennoble the memory of the prominent dead at funerals. The African-Americans were coming out of a tradition of ring dances that had marked the, if you will, spontaneous choreographies of Congo Square, the site of the old slave dances. And so jazz, in a sense, marks the coming together of the ring and the line, the ring of the African ritual psyche, where many of those burial choreographies were in memory of the ancestors, a deep West African tradition. And the line, meaning the brass bands, the European line, and that backbone begins to sort of take on a little elasticity as more hymns are played for dirges. And, of course, the high-kicking music of the second line after the coffin goes down. So when you ask about these women, they were very much coming out of a tradition of music in the churches, particular the rising idiom of jazz.
That's amazing. I want to confer on you an honorary doctorate in anthropology just listening to what you just said.
I'll take
That's
it.
That's wild. All right.
I'll take it. Nobody else has given me an honorary doctorate.
Well, we should. In case you just tuned in, we are talking to author Jason Berry about his most recent book, City of a Million Dreams. We'll be back in a second.
KRVS listeners are proud of their communities, schools, businesses, and homes. They care about where they live and improving their lives. Are these listeners your customers? They should be. Sponsor programming on KRVS. Call 337-482-1437.
I'm Marco Werman. The world is people.
Books were everything to me. I turned to books to deal with this feeling of being an outcast, and I particularly turned to fantasy because in places like, you know, Narnia and Middle Earth, I wasn't a scared little brown kid. I was brave and strong, and I was never afraid.
Join us and listen to the world.
Monday through Thursday afternoons at 2 here on KRVS.
Welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. We are joined today by author Jason Berry to talk about his new book, City of a Million Dreams. Just as we went to break, we were talking. I was awarding an honorary doctorate to Mr. Berry for his analysis of the meeting of African and European styles and traditions in New Orleans. But you noted that you approach this a little different than most historians, a little differently. And as I read your book, I was struck by the role of James Brown Humphrey going upriver on rural plantations and actually helping to develop, I think, a bunch of plantation bands that later on were part of this movement to New Orleans. I wondered if you could fill us in on that.
Sure thing. James Brown Humphrey was an ironic revolutionary, the son of a white man and an African-blooded woman. He was a musical prodigy who, at a young age, not only played several instruments, but began training musicians, moved into a formal teaching mode and was known as Professor Humphrey. So he starts going out in the late 1880s to outlying plantation towns, Raceland, Belchase, all over that belt of large estates where the growers, the planters, the owners of the land would hire him to teach their servants, hoping that having a band on the farm would keep their labor force rooted where many of these people had stayed. You know, we're only now, what, two decades after the Civil War. And one of the great scenes in the book is when he goes to Magnolia Plantation and he meets Henry Clay Warmoth, who was a highly controversial figure, and I think that's a charitable understatement by any standard of Louisiana history. He was a governor during Reconstruction. He was impeached. He remained a powerful force in the Republican Party. And there's this moment when the two men meet. And here's Warmoth, who's getting on in years, bushy eyebrows, the big walrus mustache. And here's this young Creole of color, and they're meeting to decide how much he will pay him and what James Brown Humphrey needs. And as I said in the book, did Humphrey know that Warmoth had actually put a knife in an editor who was trying to shoot him in New Orleans? New Orleans was a pretty rough town back then, not to say it isn't rough today, but it was rough in a different way. And, you know, so here's Humphrey. Here's the former governor who spends 4 days in jail. Then they release him saying, well, it was self-defense. And so I said, did James Brown Humphrey know that? Did he care? All Humphrey cared about was getting paid, making sure his musicians had uniforms. And I call him an ironic revolutionary because many of the people he trained and the bands he started, the Onward Brass Band being one of them, one of the most famous, many of these men, Kid Ory prominent among them, then made a beeline to New Orleans. So they had an education in something that would allow them to make a better living than staying on the farm. So there was quite an exodus of these men who then went into town and joined the burgeoning brass band movement at the dawn of jazz.
Yeah, it was really almost like a farm team. You know, you were out there with Professor Humphrey, and you got trained, and you learned how to have a uniform and play with others, and then you went to New Orleans, and there was that burgeoning community there as well. And brass, I guess, has a bigger tradition maybe in New Orleans than any other American city. I can't think of any other American city where trombone, trumpet, you know, has been such a prominent musical place. So moving ahead, say, up to the – I love your discussion of Danny Barker and his role. And he kind of was a connecting figure, right, between that early generation of Jelly Roll Morton, Paul Barberin, and Buddy Bolden, right? Danny Barker lived up until not that long ago, but he also connected with those people. I wonder if you could talk about some of Danny Barker and his role.
Sure. Danny Barker died in 1994 at the age of 85. So as a young man, I got to tell you a great story. I interviewed him often over the years, and I interviewed him the year before he died, just months before he died, and I said, you know, you have really done everything. You lived in New York for 30 years. You played with Cab Calloway. You played with Henry Red Allen. And Nat Hentoff said he had those big, fat, juicy chords on guitar that the jazz bands loved.
And he was a rhythm player.
He was a rhythm player.
That was the thing that killed me. I was like, wow, he did all that as a rhythm guitar player.
He was a rhythm player who was also a composer for his wife,
yes.
Louise, or as she was known on the stage, Blue Lou Barker. And I said, so you've done all this. You've traveled the world. You've recorded with everybody from Armstrong to Wynton Marsalis. And you and Lou have had this wonderful, you know, 30-year run back in New Orleans after y'all came back in 1965. And Danny was a supreme ironist, and he, you know, had this pencil-thin mustache and the arched eyebrow. And I said, there's only one thing I want to know. Well, what is that? And I said, what is the secret of maintaining a marriage for 63 years? And he looked at me and said, well, you go to church, you listen to the priest, you say your vows, and, you know, you go on about your life. And I said, so that's it. You just say your vows and hunker down, and 63 years later, you're still married. And he said, no, you have to give her the money. There have been many times in my marriage when my dear wife has said, remember what Danny Barker said. And I do.
Danny Barker
yeah. all but resurrected the brass band tradition in 1970 for a new generation of players who were coming up. He was a mentor. He was a teacher. In fact, in May 31st, Jazz at Lincoln Center under Wynton Marsalis is having a special performance dedicated to Danny Barker.
No way, really?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
With many of the people who played for him, Dr. Mm-hmm. Michael White, chief mm-hmm. among them. So he was a writer. He produced a fascinating memoir, A Life in Jazz. He was really kind of like a witness to the jazz century, and he was a perfect person for me to organize a chapter around because so much happened during his life. You mentioned Jelly Roll Morton. Jelly, with that swaggering confidence and boasting nature as a storyteller, was kind of a role model, although Danny was more modest and not as boastful.
Yeah, and that's what I really liked about the way you organized this book. I was telling Judith Merriweather earlier that I can't imagine how you actually organized it, but it fit together so seamlessly. But the way you used Danny Barker to try to connect what you had talked about earlier to what was yet to come and through his life, I mean, it was really masterful.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Let's talk about Michael White. I'm a big Michael White fan. I remember, as a musician and as a jazz musician, I had always kind of thought, oh, I don't really like traditional New Orleans music. It's cheesy. It's got a clarinet. It's, you know, it's like all this stuff, you know, guys, white guys and with banjos and stuff. But then I heard Michael White, you know, and it kind of turned my head around on that. And it stayed on my CD player at the time for months and still makes occasional appearances there. And so Michael White figures prominently in your book. How did your connection with Michael White begin, and what's his connection to George Lewis, the clarinet, and the kind of rebirth of this traditional New Orleans music?
Well, I should say that I've been working on a documentary for many years, a sort of companion to the book that is now in post-production. It, too, is called City of a Million Dreams and will be entering film festivals in the fall.
Excellent.
Michael White is the protagonist of the film. And I first interviewed him on camera back in the late 90s. I had Ford Foundation support for a big oral history video project. And then in 2005, when I had the treatment and we thought we had the story ready to go to get budget from major foundations, Hurricane Katrina hit. He lost everything. And so I filmed him going through his house. In fact, that sequence is on the website, cityofamilliondreams.com. Michael lost 4,000 CDs, 5,000 books, all of his sheet music. I mean, he's a prolific composer. And I realized over the next, well, now 15 years, that his recovery was really a metaphor of New Orleans after Katrina. He became an everyman to me. His struggle and his creativity and his absolute conviction that he would prevail became to me a mirror on what so many people in New Orleans underwent in that terrible decade, or, well, 5 years or so at least before Nagin left and Landrieu finally came and did an amazing job rebuilding the city. Michael, in many ways, I think, is that living link between Danny Barker and Jelly Roll Morton. Because it's interesting how many people are now composing new songs in the classic idiom. As you say, some people think of traditional jazz as a fly caught in amber. It never changes. But, I mean, there is a terrific young woman, Aurora Neeland, who is channeling Sidney Bechet. She's a stunning instrumentalist. I could go on at the risk of, you know, sounding like somebody is paying me from the Tourist Convention Bureau. They are not. But I found Michael's struggle so poignant and was glad to see that his emergence at the end was really all of a piece with what I was trying to say about the recovery of the city.
Yeah, it's a great story. And again, once again, you found a way to tell a larger story through an individual experience. And certainly we look forward to that documentary. How many years in the making now?
Only 22.
Only 22. Well, you know, it's we've got about 2 minutes to go in the show. And I just want to bring up Wynton Marsalis and the Lee Circle statue and Mitch Landrieu, who you just mentioned. So I read in your book that, in fact, Wynton Marsalis had an important role in those statues.
He did indeed. Mitch met with him and asked him if he would perform for a tricentennial event, and Wynton more or less said yes, but told him to take down the Robert E. Lee statue. I don't think Mitch expected that. I interviewed him at great length about this. And Landrieu realized that a great many African Americans in a majority black city were offended by these statues that went up in the wake of Reconstruction and into the early 1900s at a time when black people could not vote. And I'm sure all of the listeners saw the news coverage of Robert E. Lee coming down. In a sense, Landrieu was putting the official city on the right side of history. And although I had no idea this was going to happen, for me, it really formed a kind of perfect ending to this thematic structure of culture pushing against the law.
So right at the end, culture and law, at least for that moment, got on the same side. The city is no longer on record as supporting white supremacy or celebrating it.
Well, now the city markets the culture, mm-hmm. and has become one of the major it's more than a tourist destination. I think New Orleans is a cultural mecca, and people are starting to understand this throughout the world.
We've been talking today to author Jason Berry, who's written a book, City of a Million Dreams. He has a documentary coming out shortly that's going to be by the same title, and it's been an enormously enjoyable conversation with you. Thanks so much for coming.
Pearson, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
In Durban, South Africa, land of the Zulu, whatever new trance may hit the airwaves, the roots music known as Maskanda plays on. Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. Join me for 21st Century South African Roots, next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 here on KRVS.
Join me, Megan Brown, for Encore, Saturdays at 7 a.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette Lake Charles.
Tell your story, but I'd rather not say.